In the East, where they know a great deal more about these things than we do, a careful study has been made of the drugs that will induce the change, and they are acquainted with many substances which the British pharmacopoeia knows nothing about. There is a considerable number of drugs which are capable of producing, at least temporarily, a state of clairvoyance, and those black seeds are among the number. I don't know what they are unfamiliar to me, but I shall try and find out, as they cannot be common, and we may then be able to trace their origin and get this devil's workshop shut down. Then, said Polson, you think someone has imprinted an idea on the soul of that moonstone so that anyone who was sensitive would be influenced by it, and then added the seeds to his fiendish potpourri so as to drug an ordinary person into abnormal sensitiveness and make him susceptible to the influences of the moonstone. Exactly. And some devil manufactures these things and then sells them to dangerous fools like Irving. That is my opinion. Then he ought to be hanged. I disagree with you. You would let such a cold-blooded brute go unpunished? No, I would not, but I would make the punishment fit the crime. Occult offenses are always dealt with by occult means. There are more ways of killing a cat than drowning it in cream. Too, it has not taken you long to dispose of that case, I remarked to Taverner as Polson withdrew, profuse in his thanks. If you think that is the end, said my colleague, you are very much mistaken. Irving will certainly have another try, and equally certainly, I shall not let the matter rest. You will only get abused if you go to the police station, I told him. If you think that 12 British grocers in a jury box would hang Irving, you are very much mistaken. They would probably ask the court missionary to visit you and see if he couldn't get your family to do something for you. I know all that, said Taverner. It is quite useless to go to law in a case of occult attack, but there is such a thing as the psychic police, you know. The members of all regularly organized lodges are bound by their oath either to take up themselves or report to their fraternity any case of mental malpractice that comes within their knowledge, and we have our own way of doing justice. Do you intend to give Irving a dose of counter-suggestion? No, I won't do that. We are not absolutely certain that he is guilty, though it looks suspiciously like it. I shall deal with him by another method, which, if he is innocent, will leave him scatheless, and if he is guilty will be singularly appropriate to his crime. The first thing, however, is to get in touch with our man without arousing his suspicions. How would you go to work, Rhodes? Get Poison to introduce me, I said. Poison and Irving are not on any too good terms. Moreover, I have the misfortune to have a certain amount of fame, and Irving will smell a rat the minute I appear in the case. Try again. I hazarded several suggestions, from giving him a commission to paint poppy heads to falling in a fit at his feet as he issued from his studio. All of these Taverner vetoed as leaving too much to chance and likely to rouse his suspicions and prevent the possibility of a second attempt to corner him if the first failed. You must work along the line of his interests, and then he will fall into your hand like a ripe pear. What is the use of reading psychology if you never use it? I will bet you that before a week is out I shall have Irving begging me, as an enormous favor, to execute justice on him. How do you propose to go to work? I asked. Taverner rolled the seeds over thoughtfully with a pencil. These things cannot be too common. I will find out first what they are and where he got them. Come along with me to Bond Street. There is a man in a perfumer's there who will probably be able to tell me what I want to know. We were not long in arriving at our destination, and then I saw that curious little byplay that I had often witnessed when Taverner was in need of assistance. A man in a dirty white laboratory coat, who obviously did not know Taverner from Adam, was summoned from the back of the shop. My companion made a sign with his left hand that would have passed unobserved if one had not known what to look for, and immediately the attitude of our new acquaintance changed. We were led behind the counter into a room that was half laboratory, half storeroom, and there, amid a litter of chemical appliances, gaudy wrappers, hampers of herbs smelling up to high heaven, and the remains of a meal, the mysterious seeds were spread out for investigation. It is one of the dipterics, said the man in the white coat, The same family as the Tonquin bean, Dipteryx irritans is its name. It is sometimes used for adulterating the true Tonquin bean when imported in powder form. Of course, a small amount cannot be detected by any chemical tests, but you would not care to have a sachet of it among your handkerchiefs. It would give you a form of hay fever, and affect your eyesight. Is it imported into this country much? Never, save as an adulterant, and then only in powder form. It has no commercial value. You could not buy it here if you tried. In fact, you could not buy it in Madagascar, where it comes from, because no cent merchant would own to having any on his premises. You would have to collect it yourself from the wild vines. What trade paper do you cent makers affect? We have not got one of our own, but you could get at the cent trade through the druggist's journals. Taverner thanked him for his information, and we returned to Harley Street, where Taverner busied himself in drawing up an advertisement to the effect that a Mr. Trotter had a parcel of Dipteryx irritans to dispose of and solicited offers. About a week later we received, via the journal's office, our letter to say that a Mr. Minsky, of Chelsea, was prepared to do business with us if we would furnish him with a sample and state our lowest price. Taverner chuckled when he received this epistle. "The fish bites, Rhodes," he said. "We will proceed to call upon Mr. Minsky forthwith." I nodded my acquiescence and reached for my hat. "Not in these clothes, Rhodes," said my colleague. "Mr. Minsky would put up the shutters if he saw a top hat approaching. Let me see what I can find in my vanity bag." His vanity bag was the name by which Taverner designated an old suitcase that held certain disreputable garments that served him as disguise when he did not wish to obtrude his Harley Street personality upon an unappreciative world. In a few minutes I was denuded of my usual panoply, and was invested in a seedy brown suit of pseudo-smart cut, black boots that had once been brown, and a trilby hat completed my discomfort, and Taverner, resplendent in a greenish frock coat and moth-eaten top hat, informed me that if it were not for my ruby tie pin, which came out of a cracker, he would not altogether care to be seen out with me. We took a bus to Victoria Station, and thence, via the King's Road, to our destination in an obscure side street. Mr. Minsky's shop proved to be something of a surprise. We had thought to interview a man of the old do dealer type, but we found that the shop we sought had some pretensions. A collection of Ruskin pottery and futurist draperies graced the window, studio-made jewelry of the semi-precious persuasion hung in a case by the door, and Mr. Minsky, in a brown velvet coat and tie like a miniature sash, made Taverner look as if he had called for the washing. My colleague placed a forefinger, carefully begrimed at the consulting room grate, upon the velveteen coat of the owner of the shop. "You are the gentleman who wants to buy the Tonquin beans?" he inquired. "I don't want any Tonquin beans, my good man," said that worthy impatiently. "I understood your advertisement to say that you had a parcel of Dipteryx irritans to dispose of. The Tonquin bean belongs to a different genus, Dipteryx odorata. I can get that anywhere, but if you are able to obtain the irritans bean for me, we may be able to do business." Taverner closed one eye in a revolting wink. "You know what you are talking about, young fellow," he informed the velveteen individual. "Now, are you buying these beans for yourself, or on commish? What has that got to do with you?" demanded Mr. Minsky haughtily. "Oh, nothing," said Taverner, looking more ag and bony than ever. "Only I prefer to do business with principals, and I always give 10% for introduction." Minsky opened his eyes at this, and I saw that what Taverner had guessed was probably true. Minsky was buying on behalf of someone else, who might or might not be Irvine. I also saw that he would not be above accepting a commission from both parties to the transaction. He had evidently been bidden to conceal the identity of his client, however, and was wondering how far he dared exceed his instructions. Finally he said, "Since you refuse to deal with me, I will communicate with my customer and see whether he is prepared to buy from you direct. Come back on Wednesday at the same time, and I will let you know." We returned to civilization and put off the garments of our humiliation until the appointed time came round, when, dressed once more in the uniform of the shabby genteel, We returned to the shop of Mr. Minsky. As we entered, we saw a man seated on a kind of divan in the corner, smoking a scented cigarette. He was, I should say, 31 or 32 years of age, sallow and unwholesome of complexion, with the pupils of his eyes unnaturally dilated. The way in which he lay back among the cushions showed that his vitality was low, and the slight tremor of the nicotine-stained fingers pointed to the cause. Davina, even in his shabby garments, was an imposing figure, and the man on the divan stared at him in astonishment. "You wish to purchase the Irritans variety of the Tonquin bean?" said my companion. The man nodded, without removing the cigarette from his lips, continuing to stare at Davina, who was adopting quite a different tone towards him from that which he had used towards Minsky. "The Irritans bean is not generally used in commerce," Davina went on. "May I inquire for what purpose you require it?"
"That is no concern of yours," replied the man with the cigarette.
"I ask your pardon," said Davina, "but this bean possesses certain properties not generally known outside the East, where it is raised at its true value, and I wondered whether you wished to avail yourself of these properties, for some of the beans which I hold were prepared with that end in view."
"I should very much like to."
The unnaturally bright eyes became even brighter with the speaker's eagerness.
"Are you by any chance one of us?" Davina dropped his voice to a conspirator's whisper.
The bright eyes glowed like lamps.
"I am exceedingly interested in these matters. They are subjects worthy of interest," said Davina, "but this is a child's way of development."
And he carelessly opened his hand, showing the black seeds which had come from the poppy, which served him as his pretended sample.
The cigarette came out of the languid mouth now.
"Do you mean that you know something about Kundalini, the sacred serpent fire?" said Davina.
"Of course I am acquainted with its properties, but I do not make use of it personally. I regard its action as too drastic. It is a potent to unhinge the mind that is not prepared for it. I always use the ritual method myself."
"Do you undertake the training of students?"
cried our new acquaintance, nearly beside himself with eagerness.
"I do occasionally, if I find a suitable type," said Davina, absent-mindedly playing catch with the black seeds.
"I am exceedingly interested in this matter," said the man on the divan.
"Would you consider me a suitable type?"
"I am certain that I am psychic.
I often see the most peculiar things."
Davina considered him for a long moment, while he hung upon the verdict.
"It would be a small matter to put you in possession of astral vision." Our new acquaintance sprang to his feet.
"Come round to my studio,"
he cried, "we can talk things over quietly there.
You have, I presume, a fee?"
"I am not a rich man, but the laborer is worthy of his hire, and I would be quite willing to remunerate you for your trouble."
"My fee is 5 guineas, said Davina, with an expression worthy of Uriah Heep.
The man with the scented cigarette gave a little gasp of relief.
"I am sure that if Davina had added on a naught he would have paid it."
We adjourned to his studio, a large, well-lit room decorated with a most bizarre mixture of colors. A couch, which probably served as a bed by night, stood at an angle in front of the fireplace. From the far corner of the room issued that indescribable odor which cannot be avoided where food is stored. A blend of bacon rind and coffee floated towards us, and the drip of some hidden tap proclaimed a host's washing accommodation. Davina bade him lie down on the couch, and producing a packet of dark powder from his pocket, shook some grains into a brass incense burner which stood on the mantelpiece. The heavy fumes drifted across the studio, overwhelming the domestic odors from the corner, and made me think of Joss houses and the strange rituals that propitiated hideous gods.
Except for the incense, Davina was proceeding as in ordinary hypnotic treatment, a process with which my medical experience had rendered me familiar, and I watched the man on the couch pass rapidly into a state of deep hypnosis, and thence into a relaxed condition with almost complete cessation of the vital functions, a level to which very few hypnotists either can or dare reduce a subject. Then Davina set to work upon one of the great centers of the body where a network of nerves converge. What his method was I could not clearly see, for his back was towards me, but it did not take many minutes, and then, With a series of swift hypnotic passes, he drew his victim back to normal consciousness. Half dazed, the man sat up on the couch, blinking stupidly at the light. The whole process had occupied some 20 minutes, and he showed pretty plainly that he did not consider he had his money's worth, counting out the notes to Taverner without any too good a grace. Taverner, however, showed no disposition to go, lingering in talk, and as I noticed, watching his man closely. The latter seemed fidgety and, as we made no move, he finally said, "Excuse me, I believe there is someone at the door," and crossing the studio, quickly opened it and looked outside. Nothing but an empty passage rewarded his gaze. He returned and renewed his conversation with Taverner, but with a divided attention, from time to time glancing over his shoulder uneasily. Then suddenly interrupting my colleague in the middle of a sentence, he said, "I am certain there is someone in the room. I have a most peculiar feeling, as if I were being watched," and he whipped aside a heavy curtain that hung across an alcove, but there was nothing but brooms and brushes behind it. Across he went to the other corner and opened a cupboard, then looked under the bed and proceeded to a systematic search of the whole studio, looking into hiding places that could barely have concealed a child. Finally, he returned to us, whose presence he seemed to have forgotten, so absorbed was he in his search. "It is most peculiar," he said. "But I cannot get away from the feeling that I am being watched, as if some evil presence were lurking in the room waiting for my back to be turned." Suddenly he looked upward. "What are those extraordinary balls of light moving about the ceiling?" he exclaimed. Taverner plucked me by the sleeve. "Come along," he said. "It is time for us to be going. Irving's little friends won't be pleasant company." We left him stock still in the center of the room, following with his eyes the invisible object that was slowly working its way down the wall. What would happen when it reached the floor I did not inquire. Out in the street I heaved a sigh of relief. There was something about that studio which was distinctly unpleasant. "What in the world have you done to the man?" I asked my companion. "What I agreed to do, give him clairvoyance," replied Taverner. "How is that going to punish him for the atrocities he has committed?" "We don't know that he has committed any atrocities," said Taverner blandly. "Then what are you driving at?" "Just this. When a man gets the sight, one of the first things he sees is his naked soul, and if that man was the one we think he is, it will probably be the last, for the soul that perpetrated those cold-blooded murders will not bear looking at. If, on the other hand, he is just an ordinary individual, neither strikingly good nor bad, then he will be the richer for an interesting experience." Suddenly, from somewhere over our heads, a blood-curdling yell rang out into the gathering dusk. It had that quality of terror which infects with panic all those who hear it, for other passers-by as well as ourselves stopped dead at the sound. A door slammed somewhere in the great echoing building we had just vacated, and then running footsteps passed rapidly down the road in the direction of the river. "Good Lord," I said, "he will go over the embankment," and was startled into pursuit when Taverner laid a restraining hand on my arm. "That is his affair, not ours," he said. "And anyway, I doubt if he will face death when it comes to the point. Death can be singularly nasty, you know." He was right, for the running footsteps returned down the street, and the man we had just left passed us, flying blindly towards the flaring lights and human herd of the roaring Fulham Road. "What is it he saw?" I demanded of Taverner, cold shivers chasing each other down my spine. "I am not easily scared by anything I can see, but I frankly admit I fear the thing I cannot." "He has met the guardian of the threshold," said Taverner, and his mouth snapped shut. But I had no wish to press the inquiry further. I had seen Irving's face as he passed us, and it told me all I needed to know of the nature of that strange dweller in outer darkness. Taverner paused to push the wad of notes in his hand into the collecting box of the cancer hospital. "Rhodes," he said, "would you prefer to die and be done with, or to spend all your life in fear of death?" "I would sooner die 10 times over, I replied. "So would I," said Taverner. "A life sentence is worse than a death sentence. End of this story, and next is." The Death Hound. Well? Said my patient when I had finished stethoscoping him, have I got to go softly all the days of my life? Your heart is not all it might be, I replied, but with care it ought to last as long as you want it. You must avoid all undue exertion, however. The man made a curious grimace. Supposing exertion seeks me out? He asked. You must so regulate your life as to reduce the possibility to a minimum. Taverner's voice came from the other side of the room. If you have finished with his body, Rhodes, I will make a start on his mind. I have a notion, said our patient, that the two are rather intimately connected. You say I must keep my body quiet. He looked at me, but what am I to do if my mind deliberately gives it shocks? And he turned to my colleague. That is where I come in, said Taverner. My friend has told you what to do, now I will show you how to do it. Come and tell me your symptoms. Delusions, said the stranger as he buttoned his shirt. A black dog of ferocious aspect who pops out of dark corners and chivies me, or tries to. I haven't done him the honor to run away from him yet, I daren't, my heart's too dicky, but one of these days I am afraid I may, and then I shall probably drop dead. Taverner raised his eyes to me in a silent question. I nodded. It was quite a likely thing to happen if the man ran far or fast. What sort of a beast is your dog? Inquired my colleague. No particular breed at all. Just plain dog, with four legs and a tail, about the size of a mastiff, but not of the mastiff build. How does he make his appearance? Difficult to say. He does not seem to follow any fixed rule, but usually after dusk. If I am out after sundown, I may look over my shoulder and see him padding along behind me, or if I am sitting in my room between daylight fading and lamp lighting, I may see him crouching behind the furniture watching his opportunity. His opportunity for what? To spring at my throat. Why does he not take you unawares? This is what I cannot make out. He seems to miss so many chances, for he always waits to attack until I am aware of his presence. What does he do then? As soon as I turn and face him, he begins to close in on me. If I am out walking, he quickens his pace so as to overtake me, and if I am indoors he sets to work to stalk me round the furniture. I tell you, he may only be a product of my imagination, but he is an uncanny sight to watch. The speaker paused and wiped away the sweat that had gathered on his forehead during this recital. Such a haunting is not a pleasant form of obsession for any man to be afflicted with, but for one with a heart like our patient's it was peculiarly dangerous. What defense do you offer to this creature? Asked Taverner. I keep on saying to it you're not real, you know, you are only a beastly nightmare, and I'm not going to let myself be taken in by you. As good a defense as any, said Taverner. But I notice you talk to it as if it were real. By Jove. So I do, said our visitor thoughtfully. That is something new. I never used to do that. I took it for granted that the beast wasn't real, was only a phantom of my own brain, but recently a doubt has begun to creep in. Supposing the thing is real after all? Supposing it really has power to attack me? I have an underlying suspicion that my hound may not be altogether harmless after all. He will certainly be exceedingly dangerous to you if you lose your nerve and run away from him. So long as you keep your head, I do not think he will do you any harm. Precisely. But there is a point beyond which one may not keep one's head. Supposing, night after night, just as you were going off to sleep, you wake up knowing the creature is in the room, you see his snout coming round the corner of the curtain, and you pull yourself together and get rid of him and settle down again. Then just as you are getting drowsy, you take a last look round to make sure that all is safe, and you see something dark moving between you and the dying glow of the fire. You daren't go to sleep, and you can't keep awake. You may know perfectly well that it is all imagination, but that sort of thing wears you down if it is kept up night after night. You get it regularly every night? Pretty nearly. Its habits are not absolutely regular, however. Except that, now you come to mention it, it always gives me Friday night off. If it weren't for that, I should have gone under long ago. When Friday comes I say to it, now, you brute, This is your beastly Sabbath, and go to bed at 8 and sleep the clock round. If you care to come down to my nursing home at Hindhead, we can probably keep the creature out of your room and ensure you a decent night's sleep," said Taverner. "But what we really want to know is," he paused almost imperceptibly, "why your imagination should haunt you with dogs, and not, shall we say, with scarlet snakes in the time-honored fashion." "I wish it would," said our patient. "If it was snakes I could put more water with it and drown them. But this slinking black beast," he shrugged his shoulders and followed the butler out of the room. "Well, Rhodes, what do you make of it?" asked my colleague after the door closed. "On the face of it," I said, "it looks like an ordinary example of delusions, but I have seen enough of your queer cases not to limit myself to the internal mechanism of the mind alone. Do you consider it possible that we have another case of thought transference?" "You are coming along," said Taverner, nodding his head at me approvingly. "When you first enjoined me, you would unhesitatingly have recommended bromide for all the ills the mind is heir to. Now you recognize that there are more things in heaven and earth than were taught you in the medical schools. So you think we have a case of thought transference?" "I am inclined to think so too. When a patient tells you his delusions, he stands up for them, and often explains to you that they are psychic phenomena. But when a patient recounts psychic phenomena, he generally apologizes for them, and explains that they are delusions. But why doesn't the creature attack and be done with it, and why does it take its regular half-holiday as if it were under the Shop Hours Act?" He suddenly slapped his hand down on the desk. "Friday is the day the Black Lodges meet. We must be on their trail again. They will get to know me before we have finished. Someone who got his occult training in a black lodge is responsible for that ghost hound. The reason that Martin gets to sleep in peace on Friday night is that his would-be murderer sits in lodge that evening and cannot attend to his private affairs." "His would-be murderer?" I questioned. "Precisely. Anyone who sends a haunting like that to a man with a heart like Martin's knows that it means his death sooner or later. Supposing Martin got into a panic and took to his heels when he found the dog behind him in a lonely place? He might last for half a mile," I said, "but I doubt if he would get any further. This is a clear case of mental assassination. Someone who is a trained occultist has created a thought form of a black hound, and he is sufficiently in touch with Martin to be able to convey it to his mind by means of thought transference, and Martin sees, or thinks he sees, the image that the other man is visualizing. The actual thought form itself is harmless except for the fear it inspires, but should Martin lose his head and resort to vigorous physical means of defense, the effort would precipitate a heart attack, and he would drop dead without the slightest evidence to show who caused his death. One of these days we will raid those black lodges, Rhodes. They know too much. Ring up Martin at the Hotel Cecil and tell him we will drive him back with us tonight." "How do you propose to handle the case?" I asked. "The house is covered by a psychic bell jar, so the thing cannot get at him while he is under its protection. We will then find out who is the sender, and see if we can deal with him and stop it once and for all. It is no good disintegrating the creature, its master would only manufacture another. It is the man behind the dog that we must get at. We shall have to be careful, however, not to let Martin think we suspect he is in any danger, or he will lose his one defense against the creature, a belief in its unreality. That adds to our difficulties, because we daren't question him much, lest we rouse his suspicions. We shall have to get at the facts of the case obliquely." On the drive down to Hindhead, Taverner did a thing I had never heard him do before: talk to a patient about his occult theories. Sometimes, at the conclusion of a case, he would explain the laws underlying the phenomena in order to rid the unknown of its terrors and enable his patient to cope with them, but at the outset, never. I listened in astonishment, and then I saw what Taverner was fishing for. He wanted to find out whether Martin had any knowledge of occultism himself, and used his own interest to waken the others if he had won. My colleague's diplomacy bore instant fruit. Martin was also interested in these subjects, though his actual knowledge was nil, even I could see that. "I wish you and Mortimer could meet," he said. He is an awfully interesting chap. We used to sit up half the night talking of these things at one time. I should be delighted to meet your friend, said Taverner. Do you think he could be persuaded to run down one Sunday and see us? I am always on the lookout for anyone I can learn something from.